You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges. And follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
So welcome back, everyone. Welcome back to our second panel on security as well. We'll be talking about working for peace in our time. Clearly, while the focus in the region is on the United States, as well as regional players such as China, Japan, India, and ASEAN, the European Union has also emerged as a significant security actor. This is most often in Europe's capacity as a soft power, dealing with non-traditional security threats, but also in the area of maritime security, peace challenges, peacemaking, conflict resolution, and the like. There is also, of course, an EU dialogue on security with Asian countries on a bilateral level, but also within ASEM, the Asia-Europe meeting, which was just held in Luxembourg last week. And NATO, of course, is also a major partner and has partnerships with many, many Asian countries. So we'll be exploring opportunities and possibilities of synergies, lessons learned, experiences exchanged. With me on this panel is Mr. Sichuan Wu, President and Senior Research Fellow of the National Institute for South China Sea Studies. Thank you very much for coming here from China, Sichuan. Michael Reiterer needs no introduction here in Brussels. He's Principal Advisor at the Asia-Pacific Department at the European External Action Service, and he's also Adjunct Professor for International Politics at the University of Innsbruck. Arif Hafaz Ogrosseno used to be the Indonesian ambassador here in Brussels, and he's here in his capacity as executive member of the Asian Society of International Law. He's one of Asia's acclaimed experts and knowledgeable persons on international law of the sea. So, Paha Hafaz, thank you for joining us as well. Nancy Wei, Associate Professor in East Asian and Pacific Rim Studies at the University of Bridgeport. Thank you very much, Nancy, for flying here for this conference. And last but not least, Jamie Shea, Deputy Secretary General at NATO's Emerging Security Challenges Division. And he's also, I'm very proud, he's a trustee of Friends of Europe. So thank you very much indeed for all of you for being here. Now, the conversation in the first panel was very much about tensions existing in Asia at the moment and the potential or not of resolving them. And of course, one of the questions that was high up on the agenda was the South China Sea and the difficulty of managing different territorial claims and coming to some kind of an understanding on perhaps sharing the resources in the South China Sea. So my first question goes to you, Sichuan Wu, as head of the South China Seas Institute, about is there anything that your institute thinks is a valid lesson, a valuable lesson that one could learn from Europe about sharing and managing conflicts and potential territorial and maritime disputes in the region?
Okay, thank you, Shada. Good morning, everyone. Before I come to my questions, I would like to say a few words for those of you who might don't know about South China Sea issue exactly. Actually, South China Sea issue is a maritime dispute between China and the other four claimant states, Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia, and Brunei, in terms of sovereignty dispute and maritime jurisdiction. And the reasons why South China Sea becomes a problem, before 1970s, South China Sea was free of dispute. The reasons which are driving South China Sea become problems are geopolitical reason, because South China Sea is located between the Pacific Ocean and the Indian Ocean. The second reason is natural resources. In 1968, an academic group pronounced that there are a huge amount of natural resources in terms of gas and oil in the South China Sea area. The third reason is the EEZ regime under the UNCLOS. So those three reasons I mentioned are main driving force for South China Sea issue. Now I would like to come to my questions raised by Shada. What lessons China or Asia could learn from Europe. My observations are the first, to solve dispute or maritime dispute by peaceful means. As we know, Europe had solved our maritime disputes in the last century. Almost all maritime dispute was solved. Second, Asia, including China, should learn from Europe. Is to go for joint development in the disputed area. For instance, the North Sea joint development programs conducted by relevant countries, Netherlands, Denmark, and Germany. And the third lesson we should learn from EU is to implement a unified and integrated maritime strategy, maritime policies, and maritime economic development, and also maritime space planning program. Those are we should learn from EU. And another lesson we maybe learn from EU is security architecture construction. Currently, there are such architecture mechanisms are running or working in Asia, as just mentioned by Foreign Minister Hassan Villajuda. AIF, ASEAN Regional Forum, designed to address economic cooperation and the security issue. EIS is the Asia Summit, and CISCAP is track two mechanism to address Asia Pacific security cooperation, and 60 party talks to address North Korea nuclear issue in the Korean Peninsula, and also SCO Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which only covered China, Russia, and several Central Asia countries. So there is no architecture which could cover all Asian nations, just like Europe. As we know, EU has unified, integrated security architecture like NATO. But from my perspective, NATO is a creation against the background of Cold War and the competition between Soviet Union and the United States. So it is not good for Asia to learn from, you know, to set up such unified architecture to address the problems we are facing in Asia, maritime, you know, dispute, other, you know, sovereignty issues. Thank you.
I could just follow up with one or two points. Xi Jinping, President Xi Jinping has said very publicly, Asia, leave it to the Asians. So I was just wondering, would China take the lead, as it has on issues like One Belt, One Road, in setting up or the construct, or at least the first building blocks of a construct of a wider security architecture in Asia? Would China take the lead in trying to make up for this lack of security infrastructure?
I don't think so. China could take a lead to build up such regional architecture mechanism. From Chinese perspective, security cooperation within the, you know, current architecture mechanisms should be Asia-centered. For instance, AIF, EIS, and other, you know, current architecture. So China currently has not such desire to lead such architecture construction.
Right, and just one more follow-up. At the moment, President Xi has just finished a visit to Vietnam. He's going to the Philippines very shortly for the APEC summit. Yes. And, you know, China has very strong economic and trade links with these two countries, but it also has territorial maritime disputes with these two countries. And I was just wondering, how long can this kind of disconnect exist between China and some of the members of ASEAN, between the economic networks that you're building with such success and the, you know, the lingering disputes that you have with these two countries, at least with these two countries?
Our President Xi Jinping just concluded his visit to Vietnam, and we're going to Philippines to participate this year's APEC summit meeting. So it's good news, just announced yesterday. With regard to the question you just raised, I have several of my observations. One is economic cooperation is conducive to enhance mutual political trust and promote economic independence between China and the neighboring countries, particularly claimant states of the South China Sea issue, and also is conducive to decrease the South China Sea intention. That is the first point I would like to address. Second one is South China Sea dispute to somewhat will not affect economic cooperation between China and with ASEAN, particularly with the claimant states. You just mentioned Vietnam and the Philippines. And let me give you an example. Currently, China is the largest trade partner to ASEAN, and ASEAN is the third largest trade partner to China. With those claimant states, Malaysia is the largest trade partner among all 10 ASEAN members. But we are now has disputed with Malaysia in terms of several islands, you know, sovereignty dispute and maritime dispute. Vietnam, China now is the first largest trade partner to Vietnam in terms of trade volume and also direct investment to Vietnam. And China now is serving as the second largest trade partner to the Philippines. So in this sense, economic dispute of sovereignty issue and maritime dispute will not affect economic cooperation. And the other successful examples are China now has set up a bilateral mechanism between China and Vietnam to discuss on how to solve the dispute of sovereignty and also how to put aside the differences and go for joint development with Vietnam. And also China has already set up a bilateral mechanism with Brunei to discuss a joint development in the South China Sea area. In 2013, when Chinese Premier Li Keqiang visited Brunei. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. I think we'll come back to some of the issues you've raised about joint development and others, but thank you very much for now, Xi Chuan. Michael, turn to you. The EU is almost a reluctant security partner for Asia, or has been a reluctant security partner for Asia. Of course, the conversation is now stepping up, and I think that's a sign of changing times and signs of Europe's increased engagement with Asia. But for you, who's looked at this issue for a very, very long time, what are Europe's key security interests in Asia at the moment? What do you look at? What do you talk about when you meet your Asian colleagues?
Well, thank you, Shana. I think first and foremost, security has become indivisible. There is no geographic protection. We cannot say we don't care about Asia, and Asians can't say we don't care about Europe. And I think that brings in a very strong cooperative element. And I don't believe that there could be a security system set up only by Asians, as there is no security system set up only in Europe. Who is providing security in Europe? Well, I think we have basically four pillars. We have the European Union, we have the Council of Europe, we have OSCE, and we have NATO. And I think one of the advantages of this structure is that each and every organization has its own tasks, and it's easier to attribute a role in managing the system. Whereas if I look to Asia, it's a little bit let many flowers bloom. Sometimes there are obvious overlaps. Sometimes you're wondering what is ARF doing and what is ADM Plus doing? What is ASEAN Plus 3 doing and how does that relate to the East Asia Summit? There is an ADP and somebody is unhappy with the ADP, so he sets up another bank. I think this is a little bit the difficulty, that there is a lack of a sort of, not, I would not call it agenda setting authority, because authority has a negative connotation, but perhaps a sort of clearinghouse, who is doing what and who is best at doing what. And I think that could increase efficiency in the system. Not only because of being a European, I think that cooperation and institutions can play a role. And I will give you a concrete example, because I think it was David who was wondering whether everybody should do whatever he or she wants to do. I participated now twice in the meeting of the Northeast Asia Peace and Cooperation Initiative. It's one of the initiatives of President Park, trying to build trust in Northeast Asia. In 2014, there was a discussion, but not everybody was engaging as you expected. 2015, 2 weeks ago, I was there again, and this was parallel in the run-up to the trilateral meeting, which we have already mentioned early on. Complete change of atmosphere. Everybody wanted to be nice, everybody wanted to engage, nobody wanted to risk that something goes wrong with this trilateral meeting. Well, that's one of the beauties of a process. And you can add on another process to a process, and that's what should be this network diplomacy we are all talking about. And I think that's one of the strong points. If I look into Asia, everybody is a member somewhere. Also to a certain extent of Europe. But I think if what we were trying to do in Europe is to bring a little bit of order. And that's not only limited to Europe, we call it governance. We are trying to establish global governance, we are trying to establish regional governance, and I think the purpose of governance is to have a sort of soft rules, but at the same time to establish processes. And I think that's something we should think about. I'm very reluctant, and I think we are in the process of changing the narrative. I don't want to give anybody lessons or anything like that. I think that's what Europe has already done some damage, be it on the bilateral or on the collective level. So I think we are moving away from that. But I think the cooperative element, the best practices, the peer review, to figure out who is a driver and how can you be driver in the process. I think this is the more interesting part. When I spent now this nearly 2 weeks in Asia, I think there are always two layers. The first layer, of course, is questions asked by Asian partners. What are you doing in Europe? When I watch TV in the morning, I see refugees. What is going on in Greece? Have you overcome your Euro problem? And how are you going to deal with your British friends? okay, here the first 20 minutes are already gone. You have to explain. And then it comes, of course, to where are the Asian problems. And one of the major Asian problems, especially now in Northeast Asia, is, of course, coming to grips with the legacy of the past. That has been the big issue. That has been the big issue in the run-up to the 70th anniversary of the end of the Great Pacific War. That's the issue in Northeast Asia between Japan and Korea, but also Japan and China. And there the question always is, well, how did you Europeans manage to do that? I think there is something positive, and there is a request. I don't have to push myself, but I'm asked. And I think that's also the reason why we are invited. The other issues, of course, are North Korea, but we have already dealt with it. The other issues is the maritime disputes. And again, sometimes people are wondering why is the European Union interested? Well, we are interested, I think, for two or three reasons. The first one I have already given, that security is, you cannot separate Asia from Europe. If something is going wrong in that area, we would be concerned. Secondly, the European Union has joined the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation in the South China Sea, or in Southeast Asia, which includes South China Sea. So we are a stakeholder. And if I have signed up to a treaty, then I can talk about the subject matter of the treaty. But at the same time, we are not a party to the dispute. And if you're not party to a dispute, and if you believe in the rule of law, then you would make the comments that that's the important thing, that problems are solved according to international law, making use of diplomacy. And I think that's a message we can give with a certain credibility, because we don't have any claims, we don't have stakes in any of the sovereignty issues, but we are the believer of process, and we are also requested, sometimes from very surprising corners, to continue making statements and to speak up on the rule of law. And you have mentioned ASEM. Just a few days ago, there was the ASEM foreign ministers meeting in Luxembourg. And of course, the issue was discussed. And also, contrary to what one might have expected, it was not dodged in the final statement. But I would say it was actually quite a good statement, because all the principles are there. And that links back to the EU policy. We have to see that we come with our Asian partners, and that's what ASEM is all about, to an agreement on the principles to be applied, and then it will be up to our Asian partners in applying these principles to come up with a solution. That's not our task, that's their task, but if we can be helpful there, we will certainly try to be.
Thank you very much, Michael, for raising some very, very good points. We will follow them up. And it brings us nicely to Arif Afazo Groseno, because you did talk about the rule of law and international diplomacy, international law, and that's exactly what Hafaz has been working on. So I was wondering, Hafaz, if you could give us an idea of whether you think Michael's idea that Europe is useful in bringing its governance ideas, and what you yourself, as an expert on UNCLO and international law of the sea, think there is a potential there for abiding by certain rules in this very complex environment in South China Seas.
If there is one thing that we can learn from Europe, it's Gibraltar.
Is to?
Gibraltar. See, someone is that British or Spanish speaking? I don't know if it's ever going to be resolved after, 300 years? But it's managed peacefully. I think if you look at the South China Sea issue, in my personal point of view, this is an issue that avails itself to the extent that it will never be resolved. In any sovereignty dispute in the world, you only have two parties, It may be one or two or three rocks or small islands somewhere. But this is over 200 or 300 features with a number of claimants and in a very strategic water. So it's very difficult to resolve. Many claimants are occupying the features on the thinking that this is an effective occupation. So I don't see how this is going to be resolved. But it should be managed. And I think the managing of the conflict is a very important part, of which you can also find the examples not only in Europe, but also in our part of the world, in Southeast Asia. If you recall, Shada, the management of the Straits of Malacca in Singapore, these are straits managed by Indonesia, Malaysia, and Singapore. These are straits with no maritime boundaries in most of the part. There is no EEZ boundaries between Indonesia and Malaysia and Straits of Malacca. There is no territorial sea boundary between Indonesia and Malaysia in the southern part of Straits of Malacca or in the Strait of Singapore near Johor. But these three countries, since 1977, were able to conduct different exercises, security exercises within the Navy, safety of navigations, and protection of the environment. So there is a very clear belief by these three countries of the larger public good, which is the safety of navigation, which is the facilitations of export, of import, of tradings through waters, through ships. There is also another example that we have in Sulawesi Sea. Six countries with no maritime boundaries, Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, Timor-Leste, Solomon Island, and PNG. We work together in a water without maritime boundaries to protect coral reef. It's called the CTI, Coral Reef Triangle Initiative. So we have this a number of examples in our part of the world. And of course, in Europe, we have seen different joint exercises in a sensitive disputed area. So the next step, I think, is very important in terms of how we manage the dispute. I agree that the situation in South China Sea does not impact the economic relationships with different economic players in the regions. Of course, it's not such a concern as situation in the Middle East today, but it is better if you don't have simmering conflicts, and it is better that we can manage them peacefully. And that comes to my second comments, which links to the previous discussion in the first session about regional architecture. Regional architectures, in terms of security, you need the instruments, you need the norm shaping, but also, I think, importantly, the culture of international law, the rule of law. And I think this is something that sometimes is missing in, I would say, the Northeast Asia. In Southeast Asia, Indonesia has negotiated over 15 maritime boundaries treaty. We have taken our cases to the ICJ with Malaysia. We lost, but we give an example that we should take this issue to the court like normally in Europe they do. Also between Malaysia and Singapore, same thing. They had a case with Pedra Branca, an island off the Strait of Singapore. When they could not settle it among themselves, then they take it to the ICJ. It shows that we do have examples of the rule of law, and I think in Southeast Asia, in East Asia, I think the big countries, the countries with a longer exposure of rule of law, like Japan, Korea, they should also try to solve many differences in third party arbitration, so that it shows also leaderships that we have this culture of international law in the region. So these are a very important element. And then it comes to the arbitration issue. We are not party to the arbitration issue But I think this is also part of that rule of law development that it's going to, I would say, add weight to the next discussion on South China Sea the next year.
Hafas, Philippines did take the issue of its maritime dispute to the court, and it has got partial success in the sense the court has ruled that it is within its jurisdiction. Does that sort of set a trend, do you think, in terms of dealing with China?
Well, it depends very much on the parties concerned. I think if countries would like to be part of the rule of law and would like to instill this culture of international law, they should also look at the possibility of this avenue. But before going that, in terms of resolving the dispute, I think it's important also that the management of dispute, taking into example the existing model in Southeast Asia, the Straits of Malacca in Singapore, the model of the Coral Triangle Reef, or the model in other different region, where we manage waters without maritime boundaries. And I think it's endless examples everywhere in the world. And this would be the next step that countries need to develop. Because the problem with joint development, Shada, when you mention the word development, the next person who would show up would be lawyers. They would be asking questions. Okay, wait, which area, which law applied? What about risk sharing? What about risk taking? What about profit sharing? And then you bog down into a legal, endless legal debate, and then you will basically finish the discussion even before having a 1 hour discussion. But joint cooperation, joint activities, there will be something else.
Okay, thank you, Hafas, for making that distinction, which brings me nicely to Nancy, because Hafas has said, you know, these disputes will never be resolved. And yesterday, when we were having our private discussion, you said, but there are other ways, and Hafas has pointed to some of these other ways. I was wondering if you could give us your innovative, creative thinking on the way ahead out of this rather uncomfortable, uneasy situation we're in at the moment.
Thank you, Shada. Thank you all for coming. And this is a great pleasure to share with you my thoughts. I have, in the last year, I spent 8 months in East Asia, 4 months in Taiwan, and 4 months in the People's Republic of China. I did the cross-strait relations studies, and I also did the South China Sea research. What struck me is that if we simply think of the issue as international law, that is the wound clause or not, and that's not enough to solve the issue. Currently, the Philippines brought China to the court. Afterwards, the Chinese government issued a statement that they do not recognize the whatever result it's going to be. Interestingly, a week ago, October 30th, I believe, the Taiwan government also issued a strong statement saying that they would not, the result would not affect Taiwan's claims in the South China Sea. So for me, simply we say the yardstick is the wound clause. Nothing else before we would recognize. And that's a non-starter for some of the claimants there. So therefore, for me, I've been studying the issue through action, interaction, reaction, and a counter-reaction of all the actors in the region. What I noticed in the last few years is a pattern of competition. That is, most of the time, China waits till the other countries make a first move. Once the move is made, China will punch back with a much stronger in-kind response. Let me give you an example. The first one was with the Philippines. The Philippine government tried to apprehend the Chinese fishermen in the Scarborough Shoal. The Chinese government then sent two ships there. So they, instead of saved their fishermen, they also controlled the Scarborough Shoal. The Vietnam government published a law saying that most of parts of the South China Sea belongs to Vietnam. The Chinese government did on the same day and set the Sanxia City. So you can see then when the Philippines brought China to the court, the Chinese government started this massive land reclamation. So for me, by watching all these claimants, actions, and I noticed that none of these countries or no country has a perfect claim in the South China Sea. And no claimant, therefore, should bear all the blames that, you know, the other, or this one, or the other one is the one that started this South China Sea dispute. So then I asked myself, we need some kind of institutions to stop these vicious cycle, vicious competitions among the claimants. So the best way, or the most feasible way, is to freeze the status quo. And that is whichever country controlling whichever piece of the feature, and let's freeze the status quo, and let's design some new institutions that could change the behaviors. So it's not only, as all of you are aware, in the region, it's not just simply about the ownership of the features. It's all also about the food security, energy security, the sea lanes security, etc. And there's also this great power rivalry in the region, and that is about the future order of East Asia. So my idea is to separate the security issue from the sovereignty issue and also from the economic development issue. I believe from watching, also, I'm a professor teaching the U.S. foreign policy, and from watching what Washington has done in the last decade also in the Middle East and in East Asia and in Europe, I believe that the best way is not a military approach because it's zero sum. The best way to approach issues that is this complicated is through an economic approach. So if we could design at least four of these institutions like IGOs, intergovernmental organizations, setting up banks to support joint development, that I call it a corporation, a bank or corporation, and then the corporation will take the lead from the board, like a board of trustees that will watch and make zoning areas in the region, especially in the South China Sea. From there, and we have a separate board called the Security Board. The Security Board have the United States, have China, and major regional powers, and also EU may be a member in this Security Board. And the Security Board could think that to give the United States and China, each of these major countries, a veto power. And by setting up creative institutions, we may manage the security issues, the sovereignty issues, and joint development, and that we may help change the status quo, and also by accumulating mutual trust, and we can move to the other areas of the East Asian territorial disputes. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nancy. I will get reactions from Bahafas and Shichun Ryu in a second, but I want to turn first to Jamie. Jamie, you've been listening to the different complexities in this very, very complex Asia that we see today. Does NATO spend nights worrying about emerging threats from the region?
Well, Sharda, first of all, thank you, as always, for having had the courage to invite me to be here today, even if I have the last word, at least for now. Yes, we do, because you have two major sort of centres of global prosperity, economic dynamism, on which the whole global system depends, and you can't have both regions break down into chaos or conflict at the same time. You know, we always used to say, well, you know, if we have trouble in Europe, it's not so important. Asia is still the tiger pulling the world economy forward. And no doubt, at the moment, the best thing that we can do, and also look at Michael here, NATO and the EU, at a time when we see a rise of potential conflicts and disputes and tensions in Asia, the best thing we can in Europe can do is stay stable and stay as a model. For example, my own sense is that vis-à-vis Russia, it's very important to set the precedent that land grabs using force to impose geopolitical outcomes violating international law isn't going to be treated with impunity in Europe. That, okay, we may not be able to immediately reverse that in a geographical sense, but we're not going to accept that. We're going to stick to the norms. We're going to stick to our guns. Because, of course, if we allow those principles to be flouted in Europe, we set a precedent that others in Asia may be tempted to exploit. Secondly, we have a vested interest in stability in Asia for a very simple reason. We need the United States in Europe today, once again, big time, to reestablish an effective system of collective defence for NATO, dealing with the threats that we now see from the East and also from the South. The more we have instability in Asia, the more our US ally, already, of course, stretched with sequestration and budget cuts and a declining military, the more our US ally is going to be torn between Asian commitments and European commitments, with the danger that the US is no longer capable of playing its order role in either continent. That would be a disaster. Of course, one of the lessons, however, Sharda, is that inevitably the pivot to Asia will go ahead. The US has said that it's going to have 60% of its forces in future in the Asia-Pacific region. And therefore, although, yes, the United States is still active, it's clear that this time round the Europeans in Europe have to shoulder a much higher proportion of the collective defence effort vis-à-vis the United States than when we went through the Cold War 30 or 40 years ago. So we do have an extremely key interest. But there's another reason, too. We have increasingly, over the last few years, become dependent upon the Asian countries acting as global powers and helping us. We've had Australia, Japan, New Zealand, Korea in our ISAF mission in Afghanistan. Australia was the seventh largest contributor above many allies for a number of years. We've had Australian ships, Korean ships, Indian ships, in the Gulf of Aden, assisting us with the counter-piracy effort to maintain the sea lines of communication open. We've now got Australia flying its aircraft over Syria as part of the international coalition against ISIL. We've, I think, had some success. Look at the recent modification to the law in Japan and the interpretation of the constitution, now allowing Japan to participate in collective defence ties and international solidarity. We've had some success in bringing the Asian countries into a sense of global responsibility, particularly on the back of challenges like terrorism, on cyber threats, global climate change, and the dealing with the greater incidence of natural disasters and freak weather conditions, energy security. It's been good for Europe. And if, again, like I said with the United States, if we now see a situation where, like in Europe, Asian countries will feel that they have to focus on the home front, you know, it's back to the region, it's away from this global approach. Defense begins, you know, 12 kilometers away from your natural sea border, 12 miles. We will suffer in Europe. Let me just also say that I do not buy in at all to this theory that economic integration somehow is going to gradually ameliorate the security issues. We all know from Europe before the First World War that a greater degree of economic interdependence, trade, before 1914, Germany was by far Britain's largest trading partner in terms of investments. That doesn't prevent countries, for totally different reasons, acting against their interests and doing something suicidal, which is to go to war against each other. Let's take Russia before Crimea. You know, Russia, under this theory, should never have antagonized the West over Crimea because it had benefited immensely from an open trading economy, from investments and so on, in the 20 years since the end of the Cold War, achieving prosperity levels that it never achieved before. One could argue similarly that China has no reason to disrupt security relations in Asia because, again, it's been a massive beneficiary in terms of the peaceful rise of China hitherto from this open trading, security of investment, rule of law system. But we know that great powers act against their interests because the nationalist sense of self-assertion and pride and visibility gradually overcomes a sense of vulnerability from that type of disruption. So I would like to buy into the theory that economic interdependence would ameliorate those issues, but I don't believe it for a minute. And we talk in NATO of the Asian paradox, the sense that, yes, you know, and it was said a moment ago by one of the previous speakers, that you can continue to have, you know, growing trade. I mean, Japanese-Chinese trade is still rising, but that is not preventing an increasingly shrill rhetoric and a set of tension in security relations. So we have to be on our guard against that. And therefore, NATO has an interest in working on the type of things that can prevent wars breaking out, and where we have accumulated a good deal of experience, Sharda, over the last 30 years. Crisis management, we've worked a lot on that. You know, how do you predict, anticipate crises? How do you engage in multilateral diplomacy to head off crisis? This was the system that didn't work in Europe in 1914. There was no crisis management system. There was no set of procedures. There were no hotlines. There was no crisis diplomacy. Countries stumbled inadvertently into conflicts, even when they thought they were trying to prevent them. So I think there is a need for a European-Asian dialogue on what is crisis management. Second area, of course, is the nuclear issue. We've just had, thanks to a good deal of European and US diplomacy, but also with Chinese and Russian participation, a successful deal with Iran, which people didn't think was possible. We still have, of course, the issue of Korea, which has recently announced that it's resuming the functioning of its nuclear reactors. Can what we learn together in Iran apply now to a revitalization of the 2+6 formula dealing with the Korean Peninsula? The Koreans, of course, as I discovered when I was in Seoul a few weeks ago, are very interested in the German unification model of something which potentially could help them when the day comes on the Korean Peninsula. Others, and I'll stop briefly here because I realise that you want to debate, other areas which NATO has pioneered is confidence-building measures, where the US at the moment is trying very hard, with China in particular, to avoid maritime or air incidents, and NATO has worked very hard at this. This kind of experience, I think, could be useful out there as well. We may not be able as Europeans to contribute very much to Asia in the military sense. That's for the US. But I think as Chancellor Merkel has shown convincingly when she's visited Beijing and has sent a message on cyber, similar to what the Chinese have heard from President Obama and so on, in the diplomacy area, we can help the Asians with this kind of security structures, the architecture which they need to set up. And I think it's very much in our interest to do so. A, because a war in Asia would be catastrophic for the European economies, and B, frankly, because we need a peaceful Asia, because we need the Asians to function as global powers and not as rivalrous regional powers.
Thank you very much, Jamie. Indeed, very, very comprehensive outlook for, and also somber outlook for what you see in Asia. I do want to, before I open the floor, and please start thinking of the questions you want to put the panelists, but before I throw open the floor, I do want to ask you, Shikin Vu, to give me an assessment of what you've heard so far, and especially what Nancy and Pahafaz were saying about ways of, you know, even managing, if you like, all the different complexities of the South China Sea.
Thank you.
In this regard, to this question, from my perspective, the South China Sea issue is the most sensitive and complicated issue in the world. It is impossible to resolve such complicated issue in the future. So the only way to go forward is to conduct a joint development and not putting aside differences on the sovereignty issue, maritime jurisdiction issue. There has been a successful joint development case between China, the Philippines, and Vietnam during the period of 2005 and 2008. But unfortunately, it was expired in 2008 when the Philippines withdraw from this trilateral contract. So hopefully, there could be such a successful example because China now would like to initiate to conduct maritime cooperation under the framework of the DOC as in such areas as maritime environmental protection, marine science, scientific research, search and rescue at sea, and safety of freedom, and also crackdown on the maritime crimes at sea. So those areas, I think, could be able to start with in order to accumulate mutual political trust between China and other claimant states, and also create a benign atmosphere to improve the relationship between China and other claimant states. With regard to the remarks just made by Nancy, she mentioned about the status quo. My response is that it is hard to keep the status quo in the South China Sea area. If we look at the current new developments in the South China Sea area, the land reclamation, not only China, but also other countries, the Philippines, Vietnam, even Malaysia, have been doing so for many, many years. And also extra-regional powers' involvement in the South China Sea area. The United States, from my perspective, is, using the South China Sea dispute to contain China's rise. So in this regard, I'm, pessimistic about the South China Sea, particularly to maintain the status quo. Thank you.
Is anyone else, Bhavas, do you want to come in? Yeah.
Yeah, just want to comment what Nancy mentioned about the idea of the regional institution. It's a very interesting idea. Actually, Nancy, we have done an exercise a couple of years back with Pak Hasim Jalal in the workshop on South China Sea. There's an idea of having a regional, only regional countries under the ASEAN plus China to have some sort of organizations to oversee that. But it's just remain in the discussion in the academic, and there are a number of immediate problems that people will immediately see. One problem would be, for instance, what is the status of Taiwan? Because if it is going to be an international organization, then Taiwan could not join. So immediately you see all this infrastructure problem coming up. and then remains the discussions within the context of the academic. Therefore, we are looking at different angle, which is joint cooperations, managing it much more peacefully, especially because for important sea lanes of navigation, important preservations of the oceans in that particular part of the world. And actually, there is one, if you want to go into one specific legal obligations, you have under UNCLOS, which specifically mentioned that countries in the semi-enclosed water, like Sargasso Sea, are legally obliged to work together to conserve the environment. So you have actually the legal basis to work on that basis, on that law, if you are wanting to continue to manage it in a much peaceful manner. Now, on arbitration, of course, we have seen in many cases where the party, one party, may say that I'm not willing to be bound by the decision of the arbitration. We have seen this before. But I think the most important element that many people forget is that it will create a jurisprudence. There is a case in 1928 between the Netherlands and the United States on the ownership of an island called Las Palmas, which is then became Indonesian island. 1928, they had a dispute, and the decision of the single judge was that in order to prove ownership, you need to have effective occupation. Of course, this decision only bind the U.S. and the Netherlands. It does not bind the rest of the world. But it become a decision that is quoted, that become jurisdiction that has been used by successive courts, and then become international law. So if the arbitration later on, if it decides that small islands and rocks and features like reefs do not have 12 nautical miles, then it will become international law, whether or not a party to dispute is accepting the decision.
All right, right. Thank you very much for pointing that out. So things are changing. It is in flux, and we have to see what happens. I'm happy now to see a show of hands. If you could tell me who would like to ask questions at this point. Nagayo, you had a question for the panelists. Please introduce yourself.
Nagayo Taniguchi from Japanese media. Dr. Jamie Shea mentioned confidence-building measures. Actually, CBM, confidence-building measures, are so popular common words and over two decades, and I guess among Asian nations. But I would like to know when it will be a universal code. When will the codification be possible? Which means you might say China and Japan has a hotline arrangement, but I would like to know if it's regional, how and when it will be, and is China ready to have such a regional framework of the code of conducts and confidence-building measures? And if you might say that exists in the documents, then I would like to know when it will be universal and it will be comprehensive in the style of our final documents of Helsinki 1975, including four baskets, security, economy, and the other follow-on processes. Thank you. And what are the impediments? Why we couldn't have advanced into this next step? And everybody is talking about peace.
Thank you. I have to say, Nagayo is not just a journalist. He's also written himself many, many publications on European and Asian security architectures. So the question is well posed and well articulated. If I could perhaps start with, Michael and Jamie, you decide which one wants to go first, and then I actually would like the panel to bring this up. Michael, would you like to go first?
Well, perhaps let me make two or three other comments which I have yep. put down. I mean, as a lawyer speaking now, of course it would be possible to have legal procedure on the South China Sea. You just have to go to the International Court of Justice. It's not the tribunal which is now seized by the Philippines, but it's the International Court of Justice, but everybody has to agree. That's the problem. But the court would certainly come up with a decision if it is empowered to do so. Second, it has become a little bit a buzzword to talk about joint development. Joint development also as a sort of confidence-building measure. I think that's all fine, but one shouldn't forget before you have joint development, you have to have a sort of delimitation. What is the disputed area you are talking about? Because you will not probably agree that somebody is claiming to have joint development of the city of Brussels. That would not make sense. So I think, therefore, one has to see that there is a step before that. With confidence-building measures, I think they play, of course, an important role, but sometimes one would have to make big steps in order to really create this trust. I was thinking of that last week when I was in Korea. If one wants to engage with North Korea, probably, in confidence and trust-building measures, it might be necessary to say, well, let's talk about everything but the nuclear issue and then work our way back to the difficult issue. That's a little bit the idea of NAPSE. But on the other hand, there is a big discussion going on whether you can solve these problems through a soft approach or not, if the core of the problem is a hard security problem. And I think that the jury probably is still out. Yes, confidence building measures necessary, but how far can you go? And on the so-called red lines and communication systems, well, I talked to many people about the implementation. And I think one of the issues is, who would pick up the phone? Do you have a person picking up the phone who can make then decisions? I mean, imagine the situations which we had in the East China Sea, that one ship was actually on the radar of, and then now if the captain would call the other side, who would pick up the phone? The commander of the other side? Would it be the Minister of Defense? Would it be the President? And who would make the decision? So one of the reasons I was told several times of not implementing fully these lines of communication is because you are not sure whom to put in this heavy charge of answering and perhaps making a decision on a very short notice and without the possibility to kick it up to the next hierarchy.
Jamie?
Thanks, and thanks, Ngoe, for a very expert question. Of course, confidence-building measures don't sort of solve the, Michael pointed to this, the sort of deep-rooted sort of sources of tension, and I sort of kind of get a sense that as we experienced in Europe 20 or 30 years ago, the success is clarity of alliances and defense arrangements, deterrence, yes, and establishing clear red lines, yes, when it comes to what is sort of hostile provocative behavior, and asserting international law. You saw that the United States a few days ago sort of sent a ship at the 12-mile limit under international law, but also to sort of demonstrate freedom of navigation. And therefore, going against unilateral actions like air identification zones, which are not necessary under international flight rules. So there has to be, with any sort of situation where powers are rising and old balances are being disrupted. There has to be a sort of a clear sense of deterrence, but at the same time, engagement, you know, defense and detente. And engaging rising powers like China in a multilateral dialogue. For example, the US invites China to RIMPAC, the naval exercise every year. We've had some success now engaging China, as I've said before, on cyber. The key thing, and this is classical, typical of Europe before 1914, is that you can have an economic elite which is sort of totally sold on integration and cooperation and investments, but that can exist side by side with a military nationalistic sort of fringe in government, which at the end of the day takes the decisions, not the economic elite. I think that's totally true of Russia today. And we've got to avoid that kind of dichotomy of power arising in the Asia-Pacific countries. So one thing that NATO could help with is not so much NATO itself, because I agree, I don't see a NATO organization being created in the Asia-Pacific region, but the partnership for peace, the way in which we've sort of engaged partners on military and joint exercises and training and security dialogues. Now, very specifically and very quickly, what could CSBMs consist of? Well, I think the first thing is that the countries of the region who are sort of nominal allies could do a lot more to sort of solve their own bilateral disputes. I mean, China is obviously the big enchilada, but there's no reason why Korea and Japan should still have a very sort of difficult historical relationship and have disputes, or Vietnam or the Philippines or whatever. My friend, the ambassador, mentioned the arbitration between Malaysia and Indonesia. And where we could, therefore, help is at least to set the gold standard in terms of confidence building and arbitration among those countries over whom we have, as I say, a great deal more of influence. So at least clear that stuff out of the way, which then makes it easier to concentrate on the real issue. Secondly, military modernization. You know, we are in danger in Asia of having an arms race where modernization piles up. You know, one country gets one aircraft next week, the other country gets its package. And keeping a very close eye on this and what we do to prevent it. Transparency of doctrines. For example, in many countries of the region, there's no transparency regarding nuclear issues. I mean, Chadra, I know that you, in the India-Pakistan context, have written a lot on the issue of, you know, no first use and, you know, tactical nuclear weapons and all of that in that type of relationship. And we could certainly, therefore, have more transparency. A restriction on snap exercise. You know, what's very worrying is when suddenly, with no advance notification, a country launches some major exercise, which often could be the prelude, even as we've seen in the past, to an armed aggression. Not inviting observers to those kind of things. A pre-notification system. And again, I think a lot of the experience in Europe with the OSCE in terms of Vienna documents and those kind of military confidence building measures could be applied in Asia.
Thank you. Bahafas? Nancy?
I'm going to say something that I don't agree with my colleagues here about the military approach. Let me mention some of my observations lately. Many of the media in the West tended to support the FONOPs, so the Freedom of Navigation operations. I noticed something that is underreported here. Probably one thing is, after the FON, the Freedom of Navigation Operations, the Chinese government for the first time deployed military aircraft to the Paracel Islands. That is to say, the region is not more peaceful after the FONOP. It is actually, the tension is going up. The other thing is, I believe that the operation was a bit awkward, because before that, the Chinese government purposefully left it ambiguous. That is, they did not really say what is their territorial limits. But after the operation, it became very clear the Chinese people and the government is now see, okay, since the West is talking about the 12 miles, so we probably have a 12 miles there. So we're going to now defend that. So this type of operation is, on the one hand, increases the regional tension. Secondly, it actually makes Chinese more aware of their rights there in the region. So we are anticipating if this type of frequency goes up, the region is going to see a much higher level of tension. Imagining the deployment of the aircraft military jets in the Paracel extended the Chinese military capability to some 350 kilometers south to the South China Sea. The government never did that before, but this is the first time. If the tension goes up, it goes further down to the islands they just recently built. What does the West get out of that? I'm just saying that the military approach is not to everybody's benefit. Let's just talk about NATO. We all think about, I believe NATO is a great project, and it seized the opportunity after the Cold War, and it is a great project and brought peace and brought security to Europe. In Asia, if we're thinking of another NATO project, and the reason NATO was successful because there was an enemy at the time. But today, who is the enemy? Without enemy, there will be no cohesion to bind the group together. And if China is set as the enemy, the region is not going to be, we're going to lose the peace and lose the prosperity. Why? Because if you look at the map, China is much, much bigger than all the other neighbors put together in the East and South China Sea. And in Europe, that's not the case because the enemy is on one side. It's much easier to bound the other side. China in the map in East Asia is in the center. And a war there is not going to really hurt the United States a lot, but all the region are going to be destroyed. And think of Japan, think of Korea, South Korea, and all the other, the Philippines, etc. The region is going to be destroyed. Therefore, the military approach is not going to really bring us anywhere. It is a creative thinking about economics. Economics will make everybody better off. And economics will also, the other part of this, between the United States and China, they have to work together to bring peace and security to the peace, security, and prosperity to the region. And then I think the EU can work to bring both sides together. EU is a great economic partner, has China as a great economic partner, and has the United States as a great economic and security partner. EU is in a unique position to bring the two together. And in the 21st century, Europe experienced Cold War. East Asia, it was never cold. It was hot wars. In Vietnam, the United States lost 58,000 people, its brave soldiers. And the region lost millions. In Korea, it's the same thing. Korea lost several million people. The United States lost 50-some thousand people. It is a new time. The two hot wars were too much for East Asia. It is time for us to think of another way. Thank you. Mm.
Thank you very much indeed, Nancy. Very inspiring words. Thank you very much for the forward-looking comments as well. Chicken View, I wanted you to come in now as well and to comment on the freedom of navigation point that Nancy has made, that it raises tensions. Though I have to say, this time around, though the rhetoric was quite strong between the US and China, the reality was different. There were naval exercises that took place. There were meetings between the navies that took place. Maybe a sign of maturity of the kind of confidence building that we've been talking about?
Yeah. Before I come to your question, I would like to make a quick response to the confidence building measures. It is a bigger problem for China and ASEAN that the trust deficit between China and ASEAN and also the security cooperation is lag behind compared with economic cooperation between China and ASEAN. That's why China last month initiated the 10 plus 1 China and other 10 ASEAN members, the defense ministers meeting in Beijing, and will organize joint military drills in South China Sea area, in such areas as search and rescue and the CUES, code of encounters at sea between the navies in the next year in the South China Sea. China needs to, in a sense, China needs to address our ASEAN concerns to accumulate mutual trust. Other point out to stress is that the DOC signed by China and ASEAN in 2002 and the perceived COC, Code of Conduct in the South China Sea, now is undergoing discussion between China and 10 ASEAN members, could be seen as both confidence building measures and crisis management mechanism once the COC is in place. Could be able to deal with the absence of the crisis management in the South China Sea. With regard to the issue of freedom of navigation, I have 2 points to stress here. One is that freedom of navigation in the South China Sea not only China's concerns, but also the concerns of neighboring countries in the south, around the South China Sea area, and also outside countries, particularly United States. And also China is beneficiary from the freedom and the safety of navigation in the South China Sea. The second point is that why freedom of navigation in South China Sea is a problem now. From my perspective, the United States or freedom of navigation now is served as an excuse for the United States to interfere in the South China Sea or use the freedom of navigation as an excuse to contain China. If we look at the current situation, the newly happened event, 27th October, United States dispatched its missile-guided destroyer, Laden, to enter the 12 nautical miles of Subi Reef, which are under the control of China. From U.S. perspective, U.S. is exercising its freedom of navigation. So from Chinese perspective, United States is violating China's sovereignty, sovereign rights, and the safety for the people who are stationed on those features under the facilities constructed on those reefs. So freedom of navigation is not a problem and will be not a problem in the South China Sea area from our Chinese perspective. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jamie wants to come in very, very briefly, and then I have two questions.
No, I heard the comment, but I just wanted to point out that last summer the Chinese carried out their first military exercise in the Eastern Mediterranean, just off the coast of Greece and Turkey. We didn't say that this was interference by China in our regional affairs. China had the right to carry out this exercise in international waters, and I don't see what the US is doing remotely different in the South China Sea.
Okay, thank you very much for that. I'll take three questions. I have Kimi, Bonji O'Hara. Let's start. Kimi? But short questions, and then I'll hope we can. Yes, I have you on my list. Yeah.
My question goes to Mr. Xi Jinping. You mentioned that you don't like the Nancy's idea of freeze of status quo because status quo recognition status quo is unacceptable to China. So I'm just wondering how far China wants to go from here in South China Sea. I like Nancy's proposals, but then actually for this session, the title is Working for Peace in Our Time. In addition to, those, I think it's also important for us to be actually thinking about what will be mutually acceptable solutions for us. And then that's where I think your European experience can come in. No one mentioned Helsinki Accord, 1975, that recognized an international recognized status quo of the European border, and that certainly contributed to stabilize the region. I think that's something that Asian can learn from it. But then my question actually goes back to Mr. Wu.
Kimi. In fact, if you read the commentary we've done, we do talk about the OSCE, CSCE process. Bonji, please.
Thank you, Shada. It's my simple question to Mr. Reiter and also the Mr. Shears. Can European countries share the perception that the issues happened in South China Sea is not only a territorial dispute, but the challenging the international norms? So Japan and the United States are concerned with the issues happened in South China Sea, and the military measure is not zero sum. If somebody you challenge the international rule by forces, we also have to show the intention by forces, not battle, but showing the intention. It is the reality, I think. Thank you.
Thank you, Bonji. Clotilde, the gentleman over here.
Thank you very much. I'm Alan Giddit. You've come to the Geneva Center for Security.
Closer, yeah.
From the Geneva Center
Welcome.
For Security
Welcome.
Policy. Thank you very much. Coming back to the question of European security versus Asian security, there is something which is quite striking. Over the last 25 years, for one generation after the end of the Cold War, Europe was the one unique world model of security. There was no contest, and Europe was very happy to show its capacity through a huge range of institutions from the European Union, of course, OIC, Council of Europe, and NATO. This model worked perfectly well until 1 year and a half ago, and then it broke down. And actually, it's the European model of security that broke down in February 2014. With Europe still facing huge security challenges in eastern part of the continent beyond that. So it's an irony in a way that Europe is coming back to East Asia in a way. And one of the questions that would be interesting is how do our Asian friends perceive the lessons that Europe has been going through over the last year and a half. What does it mean for the East Asian possible, potential, perhaps irrealistic security framework? Actually,
thank you very much. I'm just very conscious of the time. So the lady over there, just put up your hand, the lady over there. Can you make your question very, very short?
Hello, my name is Linger Liu. I'm from Taiwan. Basically, I just have two major questions. The first question is about China's role serving in terms of regional integration in the area. So, because in the past decade, China has been serving more or less like a competitive, outstanding competitive, economic competitor. And I just want to know, just have they been bringing positive or negative influence to this region's internal integration? And what would be the worst expectation on them based on what kind of role they should serve in the future? And the second question is basically based on the EU's perspective between on Taiwan and China's relations. Because I do have a tiny request to the Taiwan representative, but I saw him just left. And so I want to know, like, if the two parties, they both require certain security support from the EU, and what kind of security support that EU would be actually practically provide. And I also want to know that if Taiwan specifically asks for certain kind of special support, particularly in terms of security, and how far EU can go to secure Taiwan's secure positions in that region. Thank you.
Right. Perhaps you're in the wrong capital, Brussels rather than Washington. Thank you very much for those comments. I'm going to turn now to our panelists. We have about, I can overstep the deadline by a few minutes, but not by too much. So I would like all of you to keep your comments short. Choose the points that have been raised that are of interest to you in responding. And I'll start with you, Shikinwu, please.
Well, thank you. I just make a quick response to the status quo just mentioned by Professor. When we talk about such an issue, one basic factor that we shouldn't forget is that China had resumed its sovereignty over all South China Sea islands, those insular features within the Nine Dash Line. After the World War II, according to the Cairo Declaration and the Potsdam Proclamation, and the Nine Dash Line mentioned by my friend Hassan in his remarks, the Nine Dash Line or U-shaped line was part of that event that China, you know, took over all South China Sea islands from Japan. If we look at the history in 1945, the end of the World War II, Japan surrounded. The second year, soon after the World War II, China resumed all South China Sea islands from Japan's hands. And in 1947, then Chinese government, ROC, published the Nine Dash Line to the international community. So in a sense, the Nine Dash Line should be seen as a part of the post-World War II order. And that is the real status quo, that is China had exercised its sovereignty over all South China Sea islands. So if we could back to the status quo, that means that all those islands or insular features now occupied by legitimate countries illegally should, you know, return back to China. That is the real status quo. Thank you.
Nancy?
I guess this word, the status quo, is so beautiful, and everybody uses it because everybody has its own explanation and interpretation, and it's preferred meaning, you know, for this. And I see that in the cross-Taiwan Strait relationship. And in fact, even within Taiwan, the word status quo means different things to different parties. So the current ruling party believes that the status quo means it is separately governed, but historically has a relationship with mainland China. But if you ask the pro-independence, DPP, the Democratic Progressive Party, they will give you an answer is Taiwan has nothing to do with China. Taiwan is separate, it's independent, and it has the right to select its own leader, has nothing to do with China. So we see East Asia, the word status quo means different thing to different country, to different groups, to different people. So therefore, what does status quo mean? Who determines the status quo? And that probably is one of the biggest challenges we need to work out and to have all the claimants to sit down and to determine how they can move on from here. Thank you.
So perhaps more work for the lawyers then.
Unfortunately. Shada, I would like to address the issue of what kind of security infrastructure or the lessons that we can get from Europe. I think in many discussions about this subject and trying to compare what we have in Asia and what you have here in Europe, people tend to forget that we have a different history in the establishment of the organization itself. ASEAN was established one way or another at the time to pull the sovereignty together to fight external threat, which was communism. So in Europe, it's the other way around. In order to achieve peace in Europe, you have to reduce your own sovereignty. And therefore, you have Brussels. You have a reduction of sovereignty of member states of EU in many different areas. And this is different set with what we have. So I would like to then bring this thinking to what Kang Yong, Ambassador Ong mentioned, that what we have in ASEAN, it's different. What we see in you is that you have institution, you have norm shaping, and you have rule of law. I think these are the three big elements that we can learn, but the mechanics of it would be different. Because I don't see you want to have a single currency, no?
Well, I think there are some people in this room who would agree that Asia shouldn't embark on this exercise at this moment, definitely. Jamie, please.
Well, I think the first thing is that we want to avoid Asia dividing into sort of competing blocks in the way that sometimes looking at Europe, you know, with Shanghai Cooperation Organization, Euro-Asia Union, CSTO, Russia sometimes presents it as, you know, you're either with me or against me kind of thing. You're either in my world or you're in the other. And we don't want that sort of nascent sort of European syndrome transferring into Asia, which means keeping things open. Embracing China, I'm not at all in favor of military solutions only. I want to make that crystal clear. Involving China, as I mentioned, in the exercises, in trade, in Asia-Pacific fora, and also encouraging bilaterally countries like Australia also to have very strong relations with China. There's good news in the region, the way in which, for example, Vietnam now has emerged, for instance, the way in which India now is also emerging into regional security arrangements and naval exercises. It's not all gloom and doom, as we often sometimes portray. And again, you know, also getting the message across that China is a global power, and which is buying up land in Africa for its food production. 4 out of 5 ships laden with oil leaving Saudi Arabia today go to China. They don't go to Europe. So getting China more involved in stability in the Middle East, diplomatically in Syria and elsewhere, as it becomes more economically dependent on the oil and gas from the region. So there are opportunities, Shada. That's what I want to say, opportunities. So as well as risk, we need obviously to reduce the risks, and we need to seize the opportunities. And I do agree with what an earlier speaker said about the OSCE model. It's setting down a basic modus vivendi in terms of set of rules while developing cooperation in soft areas like migration, like women in armed conflicts, like arms transfers, cybercrime, all of these kind of things. Yep. I mean, where the security issues are hard, let's try to work around by developing cooperation in those softer areas where countries often see a greater interest. For example, China is the first country to come along at the United Nations and talk to us about the dangers of terrorism, about jihadism and radicalization as it looks at some of the issues in its eastern provinces. And the Chinese have been extremely helpful to us recently on Afghanistan. Afghanistan, because they recognize that ISIL taking over in Afghanistan is as bad for them as it is for us. So there's an active diplomatic agenda, and we should focus on that as well. Just on the South China Sea, I think that the key things are multilateralism. This is not something that can be handled by China simply bilaterally with the states concerned. China has to accept that it's legitimate at ASEAN to talk about this issue and not to exclude it from the communique. Secondly, transparency. You know, what are you really doing? I hear many different versions about what the land reclamation in the South China Sea is all about. A recent Chinese professor told me in Seoul that it was all about creating humanitarian climate change intervention facilities. If that's so, then let's see how we can use that. That might be useful. Finally, not using proxies. I mean, hybrid scenarios where you use sort of fishing boats to sort of open up something which is clearly not innocent, but which is disguising the activities of the state. Let's get away from these hybrid warfare scenarios and be transparent about what we're doing. And finally, if we really feel that we have a very watertight legal case, then let's go to a court. If we've got all of the winning legal arguments, we shouldn't be worried about legally binding arbitration.
Thank you. Michael. Thank you, Jimmy.
Yes, I think, is there a challenge to international norms? Yes. Is that a problem per se? No. There are always legal disputes, and I think the important thing is that if you are challenging whatever it is, that you reveal the legal base on which you are challenging what, and then that you make use of the procedures which are at your disposal in order to get an issue resolved. That's the rule of law thing, which I was mentioning several times this morning, and which would also be my answer to the whole difficult complex of Taiwan. I think one of the issues Europe shows and can show is that you engage according to rules of law and procedure in giving an example. And their engagement is certainly important. I mean, just when we look back briefly, how was Europe brought together? It was through constant engagement at the end of the day. It was not the wall. The breaking of the wall was just a final step, but it was constant engagement with different countries which softened them up. And I think that's probably also a lesson to be applied to Asia. When you isolate, you never can win. And that's very much an Asian experience. When was China weak? When was Japan weak? When they were in isolation. When did they gain strength? When they open up? When they engaged? With a certain time difference, but I think the message and the experience is fairly clear. It is engagement. And I think, Jamie, I just would like to underline one element. I think that's the transparency element. If we talk about CBMs, we are talking about transparency. And I think that's also probably one of the issues which we can show in Europe. There's hardly anything more transparent than the European Union. When we try to keep something secret, it works perhaps for 2 or 3 hours. So this is transparency in international negotiations. And I think that's something which also helps probably in trust and confidence building. The last point I have noted here is status quo. I think status quo is a rather difficult concept, and I would like to avoid it whenever possible, because status quo is always defined by one party, and you can be sure that the other party is not agreeing, because status quo is very much in the eye of the beholder, and I would not like to build my rule of law concept on status quo premises, because this is sand and this is no concrete.
Thank you very much. Does anyone want to come in very, very quickly? Otherwise, I'd like to wrap up the conversation. Everyone's, yes, I thought you might, so giving you the opportunity. Yeah,
just one word. I hope through this event, friends of Europe were not only friends of Europe, but also for Asia. Thank you.
Thank you, yes. Did you say that we are or we should be?
Should be.
Absolutely. We are great friends of Asia, in fact, and I think that's one of the reasons we are holding this conference. I'd like to say just a few words to wrap up. I think we haven't actually sorted out things. We haven't actually achieved the aim of mapping out a roadmap for peace in Asia. But I think all of us have made very, very significant contributions, perhaps not peace in our time, but I think what we have seen is that steps are being taken, and that's exactly what we are referring to here, Mr. Chikunvuyo and others, is the steps are being taken, and how can we, as part of this globalized, interconnected, interdependent world, work together, share experiences, learn from ASEAN, the ASEAN way, and learn from Europe and NATO perhaps about how to move forward and build a more peaceful future for everyone. As we've said, stability is important for all of us here, and what happens in Asia affects us, and what happens in Europe, and we can see this, is affecting Asia as well. So thank you very much indeed for coming, for participating, for listening. Thank you to our partners for helping us to organize this, and thank you very much to Pahasan Wirajuda and to all our panelists, first session and second session, who have helped to make this such a successful event. Thank you.